You're tuned in to the Vintage House Show, home to the original stories of the history of house music as told by the legends, pioneers, and icons. Hosted by Kevin Mega McFall, Lori Branch, and Lauren Lowry.
Good evening to you.
These guys are all big influences on me and certainly house music.
No, that does not sound like a life.
Walk most around with that collar popped up.
Yeah.
Hey, do this. Yeah. You go
so,
over there.
Yeah. So let's go on that. I want to talk a little bit about each of your illustrious careers, because you guys have done a lot of. You've done a lot. All three of you have done amazing, you know, have had amazing contributions to what we call house music. You know, this is the Vintage House Show. And so part of what that is about is celebration and preservation. This is Lauren's framing. But the celebration and preservation of Chicago house legends and Chicago house music. And I think...
Hey, it's your main man, Mega, for, you know it, another episode of the Vintage House Show. The Vintage House Show is the premier show dedicated to capturing the history, the culture, and the business that is house music. We are powered by the Modern Dance Music and Research Archiving Foundation. Yes, it's a mouthful, but it is an organization dedicated to building out the artifacts that are rooted in the story that is house music. As always, I'm excited because we've got a great guest joining us for this episode. And of course, I am your main man, Mega, also known as Kevin Mega McFall. And I am proud to bring into tonight's episode a gentleman who's actually someone I've known for many years, actually well before house music, and his name is Eric E. Smooth Miller. Welcome to the show, E.
Mega. What's hey. Going on, brother?
You, sir. I am so excited to have you. I think you've been on the show in the midst of COVID and all of those times that we've managed to navigate past. And so it's great to have you back.
Big fan of the show. And that intro is crazy. That intro is just like, man, a retrospective of the whole scene, the community, you know?
Well, it does capture some great moments. Certainly being part of the opening montage, I think it was you, Gary, Jackmaster Wallace, and I at one of the many chosen few festivals that we've attended. And so it's pretty cool to actually have you, like I said, on the opening montage and now here sitting with us on the show. We are celebrating the 40th year of the release of a house oriented or designated record. 1984 was that monumental year. And so here in 2024, there's certainly an abundance of activities going on here in Chicago and perhaps outside of Chicago as well. But we're certainly tuned in and excited about what's happening in the Mecca of house music.
Right.
So tell me how your year has been going, and you as a DJ, remixer, producer yourself, you've continued to put a stake in the ground around your contributions and others' contributions to this genre. So how have you been doing, first and foremost?
I've been doing well. So, you know, for me, it's a little bit of a renaissance in the sense that in some ways I've reverted back to the fan that I was when I first met this thing, you know, this culture. I am more semi-retired, so to speak, from the actual creative part. But from a culture standpoint, I'm very much involved and very much, you know, still passionate about, you know, everything, and have become, you know, a little bit of a historian in terms of trying to have an unbiased agenda and keeping the facts straight, history that we all share and that we live through. And also a disruptor in some ways. You know, I've, you know, taken on a role of speaking truth to power in a lot of ways. Like, for example, to me, I don't think it should be the 40th year of house music. I think it should be the 50th anniversary of house music, because our culture started 50 years ago. And just like hip hop just, you know, saw its 50th anniversary, not 50th anniversary of when the first record came out, but when the culture started. And I think that, you know, I'm a company guy. I toe the line, right? But I was very adamant as this was first building that, no, guys, we're making a huge mistake here. It should be the 50th, because after coming off of the 50th anniversary of hip hop, it really sounds like pew, pew, pew. They shut off a cannon and we came out and said pew, pew, pew.
Yeah. Like in the Harlem Nights, that scene with Eddie Murphy.
That little thing. So, but you know, I was overruled by the founders, by the, you know, the powers that be. So I you know, I walked the company line, but I just think 50 years is better for business.
Well, I want to commend you though as well for being on the side of getting the facts right. Like, I've outlined this show as one of perspectives, opinions, but also facts, because I know that's what you'll help bring. And often my co-host of the show, Lori Branch, attributes very often your description of the house music canon. Can you talk a little bit about what that canon actually entails and why it's so important?
So the canon entails, there's a culture of house, and then there's the genre of house. And like any genre, there was a movement before the genre began. And the genre is a result of all of these inputs from the culture. And then something different, done different, that then establishes. And I studied it with jazz. I studied it with rock and roll. I studied it with blues and even hip hop to see, okay, what makes it all? And we get questioned about this all the time. So that's why I felt like we really needed to understand and be able to articulate it in a very tight argument, so to speak. Why house is house? Why house isn't just a continuation of New York disco or the club music that was happening post disco in New York that we actually played and considered them part of house culture? So it gets really convoluted in there. So that's why you need so much clarity and understanding why house is house. And it starts with, first of all, the culture, and then how that migrated to a genre. As the culture continued, the culture still exists and is continuing.
That, thank you for that explanation. And it's actually certainly an area I wholeheartedly agree with you on, because we've seen and heard instances of people on their platforms sort of misstate what sort of transpire, but we're all working around the elevation of this genre from the point of its origin, right? The origin stories. And so I think what that does for us as Chicagoans, and I'm speaking of you and me in this conversation at the moment, mm-hmm. There's a level of passion, right, that informs how we feel about this culture and genre, how we want to ensure the narrative when the next generations come, that they've got it right and they're able to be informed from a place of facts versus hearsay or speculation or even misinformation. And so what often results when there's this passion is a level of disagreement. There are some trends and some things happening around, you know, what I guess we've arrived at as this moment that acknowledges one of the milestones. But talk about what some of those hiccups, if you will, have mm-hmm. been in your mind's eye around getting the story right.
So I think that one of the biggest enemies of getting the story right is ego. So ego and agenda, right? So that's the first thing. I think the second thing is house music itself has been a little bit of a bastard child, even from the beginning. The old guard, the R&B community, the R&B musicians and stuff, radio programmers, it wasn't received well. I don't know if people remember that, but it was not received well. My dad used to call it that boopity boop music. You know what I mean? So from that perspective, it's just always had a lesser than thing going on. I think that another barrier to it, unfortunately, because Frankie is not alive, so much was placed in Frankie's lap, Frankie's shoulders, because of the name of the music coming from the warehouse, shortened from, you know, the warehouse, and Frankie being assigned the godfather. There's some huge misnomers that occur with that. For example, the average person does not know that house music was not played at the warehouse.
That's right.
Meaning house music, the genre. House right. music culture, of course, was named after the warehouse, but the genre was not played at the warehouse.
It most was disco and R&B.
Absolutely. But most people don't know that. So, and without Frankie being here to set some of those records straight, we place even more of that in that space. And what it does is, you know, in reality, there's only 100%, right? You can play with it all along, but 100% is the finite, right?
That's
if you
right.
give 70% to the warehouse and Frankie and leave 30% to the rest, then that doesn't really represent the story. Now, I am very controversial in saying that Frankie's probably only 20%. The warehouse is only probably 20% of the story. But, you know, I know that that's a very disruptor point of view.
I think I and our listeners have to value that perspective because you started from a place where you establish that there's a distinction between the culture and the genre. And yes. we often talk about the genre being heavily related to disco. Some call it the revenge of disco. I don't like that that term because it diminishes. It diminishes the power of the origination of how this thing came to be. But again, this is a conversation about perspectives, opinions, and some facts. So I appreciate that you share that. I think they're depending on the lens in which one looks at the story, you know, maybe that percentage shifts a bit, significantly, potentially. Yeah. I wonder even what Ron Hardy would say about the origin of house music, and there's not often that conversation that's had.
And here's what's funny is I actually then, and going back to, I'm hypocritical in the sense of my 100%, because then I give Ron Hardy an equal 20%. And here's the reason why. See, this is a part that people cannot factor in. If you were DJing during that time, right?
Yeah.
There was a complete shift. And I'm going to speak, Chicago is very segregated, right?
Absolutely.
So as the Hot Mix 5 mix show proliferated throughout the city, right? It created fans and it created DJs, right? And
yes,
the majority of the DJs weren't doing anything new. They were just mimicking what was happening on the Hot Mix 5. And generally you pick the lane.
Yeah,
right. Exactly. And all of the straight black kids mimicked Farley, right?
Yeah.
All of the Hispanic kids mimicked, well, this is even before right. Julian was on, mimicked Ralphie and or, Kenny and maybe yeah. a little Scott. Scott probably influenced the black kids a little more, right? And yeah. then the white kids were influenced by Mickey and Kenny. And in the way that we were very segregated as a city. Okay, so you take that into account. So based on that, you were doing, in 1982, if you were DJing in Chicago, you were scratching, you were doing backspins, you know, you had
double tracking,
you just all of that, right?
Phasing, yeah.
Phasing,
all the stuff.
So every record, you bought two copies because yes. that was really, it was more emphasis on the tricks that you were doing with the records than the actual programming of the records.
Take us back, E, take us back.
And for the most part, the crowds accepted almost whatever you would play because it felt like if it sounds like this, it's that music and I'm about that music. So there was a lot less questioning of music that you would play. So there was a time, yes, you had your filler records and stuff like that. But in terms of peak records,
yes,
everything was almost a peak. So Calling All Boys was a peak. Don't You Want Me Baby was a peak. Beat the Street was a peak. All of these records were peaks because they were so different than what was played on mainstream radio that as long as it wasn't that, it was acceptable to that crowd. So your emphasis was a lot more based on what you could do with the record than even how the record sounded in some cases. There's a lot of records that we played that, yeah, they were okay records, but it was more the tricks that you were doing with them that made those records popular.
I'm enjoying this point in particular, the whole conversation, but it also takes us back to the fact that rock and roll music was being played and interjected in these mixes and in this experience, as well as
from a house culture.
Yeah.
From a house culture.
The culture.
Yes.
As well as the Euro disco or Italo disco, depending on what was your favorite. Capricorn, I Need Love was certainly great in that sense. But I think there's also a piece, and I'm sure you'll speak to it, but I'm going to go ahead and tee it up for us. You talked about the Hot Mix 5, WBMX specifically, because that's where it really started. In fact, I came across this great picture from Chicago Fest that was on one of these, old time Chicago Facebook groups. And there, WBMX had the Hot Mix 5 come to Chicago Fest. And I think that was one of the first times I saw them in person, any of the mixers. Mm-hmm. But it was the call out that the show, the Saturday Night Live Ain't No Job Chicago Dance Party, reached households of people who were coming of age, right? They were high school, in some cases even elementary school. And that part of the culture and experience started to seep into the high school sock hops, right? The dances. You, as a person who attended Mendo,
right,
and the bi-level discos, got to give some attribution there as well.
Well, okay, so this is another nuance, and excuse me if I get super nerdy in the weeds with this, because I really am a study of this thing. If I was going to do anything, my PhD would be in this, right?
Talk to us, man.
So what is unique about Chicago and taking it back to the Hot Mix 5? You got to remember, at that time, think about the introductions of the Hot Mix 5. So I'm Mickey Oliver from Janelle's Disco. I'm Kenny Jason from Dunnigan's or something crazy like that. Farley was from the Playground. So when you think about that, there was a section of this dance music that was being enjoyed by a 21 and over bar club crowd, right?
Yeah.
But then Farley was really more representative of a younger audience that had parties in places like Sours, the Penthouse, and then ultimately the Playground, the Music Box, et cetera, et cetera. So he represented that crowd, but that crowd also germinated from Mendel parties, from Quigley parties, from and then this is something that really isn't talked about. And because I'm from that class, the Legion of Basement Parties. So that's something
yard joints. Yeah.
Huge, huge. So while there were, you know, the Farleys and the Andres and the Hurleys and, you know, of course, Wayne Williams, whatever, doing these parties at Sours. Some of the reason why I never attended the Warehouse, I never attended the Music Box. You know why I never attended the Music Box? Two reasons. I'm just going to keep it real. Number one was I was a working DJ in all of these house parties, all of these basement parties that were going on. So on most weekends, I was DJing somebody's party or helping somebody else DJ somebody's party. So that was a whole thing for us, right? But then on the other side, I was a teenage boy and, you know, I was spending some of that time trying to be a teenage boy. If you know what
yeah.
I mean.
Yeah.
And those parties went late and I had to be home at a certain time.
I went to grade school with you. I know. See what I'm saying?
The ladies were in the picture. So anyway, my point of saying that is that there was such a movement in that way that, back to my original point, did not include the Warehouse. The Warehouse held 200 people. It was a place where Black gay men, well, not even just men, but mostly men, could go and let their hair down and be who they wanted to be and realize the fullness of their person, right? So it's not like that was something that was heavily televised. It was very underground. So to think that when you put the science to it, place holds 200 people. Yes, by the time the night is over, there's probably 300 people to pass through. I can even give you 400 people to pass through, right? 400 people in that time that it was open does not build the wave and the movement alone. It's just no way possible that 400 people, if you said over a span of 10 years, 15 years, maybe, you know what I mean? But really you're talking about over a span of 4 years, the Warehouse was open.
Yeah, 79, 82, so yeah, about yeah. 3 to 4 years.
Yeah, so in that term, it's just scientifically not possible, and you didn't have social media back then. You didn't
that's where I was going to
challenge. You didn't have cell phones back right. then. So right. really, it was literally word of mouth.
Yeah, the real organic influencers. And so I'm going to put forth my perspective mm-hmm. because I did go to the Warehouse. It was the winter break of my freshman year of college. I came up from Champaign, Urbana. Mm-hmm. There was a mystique, yes. right? That was the aura that was the Warehouse. And one of my friends, Lori Peppers, another Lori, mm-hmm. Who I was attending college with, told me and actually some of your fellow Mendel Marnarks, Warren Wilson and mm-hmm. Tony Anderson. She's like, yeah, you all should come through because, you know, we were all down at U of I together. And so we met her there and we couldn't get in. right? They were, they had flipped to membership night. You got to be a US Studios member. And unless you are, you can't get in. And we just hung out for like, it was at least a couple of hours. And then eventually, you know, we went and approached the door again and we were granted admission. And so the whole experience of going down the stairs into the area with the music pulsating, like you felt every note, every beat, that eponymous experience was something that I left the venue wanting to recreate in other places and spaces. And I think that piece is what happened there. I've begun using this term. There was a level of appropriation that took place, you know, in taking from that place and space, where, as you described, it was great for the gay and queer community to be able to be free and authentic in who they were. And yet it got a sort of, other visitors started coming in and taking pieces of that away. And I think that helped amplify what that experience was. And then in fact, morph it, right. It
was a mutation.
It got mutated. Yep. I like that word even better. It got mutated as we went to some of these high school dances and rented out venues like Sours and the Loft, which were other types of venues by day, and party places and spaces for young, underaged people to attend at night.
And well, I'm glad you brought this up, because here's an important part, right? To your testimony and my testimony, right? So you graduated college in what year? I mean, you graduated high school in what year?
I graduated high school in the spring of 81, May 81.
Right. So you caught the tail end of the warehouse then.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So were you DJing at the time?
I was actually DJing in Champaign. Yes.
Right. With Jerry McAllister and Roy.
Well, yep. Jerry came the year after that. Actually, Cedric Ball and
I remember Cedric Ball.
Yep. Got to DJ. And actually, Joe Smooth. Was down there with me just that one year, 81 to 82.
So where I'm going with this is you left that Frankie experience, right?
Yes.
But you came back DJing like Farley.
Absolutely. I had the WBM. I was backtracking, double tracking. And
You didn't hear any of that at the warehouse.
I did not.
That's what I mean by in terms of level of influence and the whole thing. And I love hearing about how that happened, because when you think about it, so many of us straight kids knew the myth of the warehouse, right?
That's
and
right.
All of that, but had not experienced it. So it was all secondhand information.
That's right.
You know what I mean? A lot of it was secondhand.
It started. My interest and curiosity started out from secondhand information, for sure.
Yeah. So then when you take that, right? So one of the tenets of the warehouse was the sound system, this Richard Long sound system, right?
Absolutely.
Guess where that Richard Long sound system existed outside of the warehouse? In Chicago. Nowhere.
That was the first venue for it.
So when you think about that, right, the experience that you had at the warehouse was still being mimicked by Ken Samuels, who was setting up the sound at Mendel, was being mimicked by Frenchie, was being mimicked by CH and Company at Sawyer's, and all of these different places. But then guess what? It was also being mimicked in people's basements. You know. I can remember setting up a stack of house speakers and having a tri-amp house speaker system. You know what I mean?
Some Jensen cabinets. And,
yes, absolutely. You already know. Yep. Jensen 15s turned on this side and become a basement. But my point is that so much emphasis is put on the way that you, the experience that you had with the music in that sound system, but yet probably 95% of the people never heard it in that context. So again, that speaks to the power of the Hot Knicks 5 and that movement. And what I was getting to with Ron Hardy was that there was a point at about 1983, and I assume that was right about the time where the Music Box took hold, because it had a couple of iterations that didn't quite catch yet, you know, when it was R2 Underground and all of that, right? So when the Music Box finally took hold, right, the way that Ronnie played changed everything. Everything. Now, instead of the emphasis being on the tricks and stuff that you're doing, the emphasis was on the edits that you had. It was on the amount of exclusive, unreleased music that you had. The emphasis was on playing with the energy that a lot of people attributed to his drug habit. He played the music a lot faster than everybody else.
Yes.
So that drove Hurley, that drove Farley, that drove Andre. Maybe Andre was still probably more influenced by Frankie. But it drove an energy there that you had to now match, because the crowd was used to that type of energy, right? And a lot of the records that we played didn't necessarily give that level of energy. You know what I mean? So you had to interject that energy in. So Ronnie had so much of an impact on the house culture and subsequently the house genre. That again, I would say, and this is no diss to Frankie. I love, you know, Frankie when he was alive, helped me in so many ways besides the general influence of the scene. He helped me directly. So I would love to have this conversation in the room.
Yeah, for sure.
That from his mountaintop, if you will, right, he had some influence, but there was a lower influence in the valley that was really impacting the masses. And that shift between the Hot Mix, and this is strictly for the Black DJs, because you got to remember, Chicago is so segregated.
Yeah.
So while the Black DJs did a total shift into the Ronnie influence, the white and Hispanic DJs continued on their path. So the Bad Boy Bills, the Julian, they continued scratching, they continued doing the tricks and that sort of thing. And then that transferred over to B96. So then when you look at house music from 87, 88, when that shift happened in well into the 90s, it became a B96 thing.
That's right. BMX went, they stopped programming the mix shows. Yeah.
But that's the time when we did a shift as well. So we don't talk about that enough either, is the exodus that Black people did from house music.
I want to, because I've had him on the show once, but I also want to give a shout out, because this is my boy. We went through some times together, but Edward Get Down Crosby, who he was brought into the next iteration of the Hot Mix 5.
Right. And the things that he was doing on GCI and all that stuff. But when he Mike Dunn and then eventually Steve Maestro, I got to say, it was great. Back. Yeah, but it wasn't really a popular time.
They had an uphill battle.
Had an uphill battle. And part of that is because the Black community as a whole did an exodus to rap music, rap and hip hop. That was then the advent of New Jack Swing, and all of that went that way. And it became at a club called Dejois, right? You would go to Dejois, and this is probably circa 91. You would go to Dejois, and 80% of the night was
New Jack Swing
and all that stuff. And then the last 20% was, okay, now we're going to play some old school hip hop. I mean, old school house music, along with, you know, the current stuff, the, you know, the Liddell Towns or New, the you know, those records.
Some Out Here Brothers and
That even predates Out Here Brothers.
Mirage.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. That came like mid 90s and later.
Yeah.
Yep. So I wanna switch gears a little bit because we could dedicate
a whole show just on that.
The culture. But there's, you know, I talk about Vintage House Show in the context of certainly the music first, culture. But one of my strong affinities is around the business because, you know, that's where I sort of plugged in and found my niche in trying to support all the creators, right, in elevating and making the business make sense. Today, here in 2024, right, the business of house globally is booming. There are some challenges still with, I think, the business, particularly here in Chicago, flourishing in the way that one might hope and expect it to flourish. So I want to get your perspective. You know, there's a Chicago, the city of Chicago's Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events is hosting their annual house music conference, which on some sides of it is intended to try to uplift the business knowledge among the Chicago creative community. On the other hand, it's intended to showcase some of the talent. Can you talk about that platform and others that you've seen with this intent? Maybe they hit the mark, maybe they missed the mark, but what are your thoughts about the business of house music and how Chicago either supports it or needs to do more?
So I am very split in that, right? I'm very split in that because I do appreciate, you know, I'm old enough in this thing to remember when it didn't get its just due. I'm old enough to remember when, and this is probably most of the time when it's used in a lot of ways. So like we mentioned the Chicago Fest, you know, house music. Oh, that's great. Let's have house music. You know, during Chicago Fest, and you know, it's erupted from the streets, but then it doesn't get its mainstream just due. To me, a great example of this is there was a time when B96 was playing Daje, Brighter Days. They were playing the because it was so big in the streets.
It's infectious,
infectious, and they were playing it to death, but they never actually put it as an official ad. So
to rotation
where you could actually then use that to go get more ads around the country and the business that they're normally in. And that's just a perfect example of how house music is used in so many ways. So back to what you asked me, you know, I think that it's a great thing that they even do anything, right? So appreciative on that side. Because then after you take the appreciation, you say, okay, that take a bite of that. Now you taste it and you say, yeah, but this isn't what it's supposed to taste like, you know? And then, you know, I'm kind of a disruptor in the sense of, I just feel like it's always executed in a lot of ways so wrong. And it's because it's executed in a way that is not, you know, of the culture, people of the culture. And I realize the culture is very diverse. I realize that there are many different perspectives on house music. And I think that we can do a better job, they could do a better job of bringing the right representatives from each parts of the culture to the table, find some common ground that everybody agrees on, and then take a piece of each side and include that. And, you know, in true negotiations, if everybody's pissed off, you know what I mean? If everybody's happy but a little pissed off, then you did a good job of compromising everybody's stuff, you know.
I appreciate that perspective and want to provide full disclosure that in the past, the past 2 years, 2023 and 2022, the Vintage House Show had the privilege of leaning in and contributing to the programming of the Chicago House Music Conference. We had some good outcomes from that.
If I can just interrupt you to say that anybody who's ever consulted before knows that consulting is two parts. It's the expertise that you bring, but it's also the client actually listening and utilizing that expertise.
Hello. Right.
Yeah. Because consulting into a brick wall does nothing. I got the brick wall. Yeah. Consulting into a
brick wall does nothing. Nice use of that background metaphor. I appreciate that. On one hand, I think there's also this dimension of celebration, right? Mm-hmm. It's intended to showcase and celebrate what was originated here. But I think one of the reasons you and I, are pretty well aligned on some things here is we're forward looking. You want to look out into the future and see this thing continue to grow and expand. And, we're both girl dads, right? We want, yes. Maybe our daughters will have, some affinity. Same. So their peers, their friends, at least may have, a taste of the apple that, and they have an affinity for it. So they have to have an understanding of what it is and what it isn't and what it can be. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if there's enough of those vehicles to help, foster that understanding out there. That's my opinion.
So that's where we probably disagree, right?
Okay.
So I think that when you open your mind, a bit, not to say that your mind is closed, but I'm just saying when you look at it from different perspectives, house music is being expressed in so many different ways. One of my favorite things is my daughters play the playlist in the car. You know the playlist, right? And they're hitting these, Dua Lipas and Ariana Grande and of course Beyonce, et cetera, et cetera. And every time that there's a dunks, 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 right? Even if it's just in the background, it's the bass for the rhythm, but there's other stuff on top of it. I always point out, that's house music. That's house music. And whereas they don't necessarily care that that's where it came from, probably in the same way that, our parents hearing some hip hop stuff that included jazz or some of the old soul music, they're pointing out that's jazz music, that's soul music, and we didn't care. We just wanted to hear what we heard. The point is that it's representative there. So it's not like it's a stretch. I think that either we have to divest from wanting the genre to be always front and center, or we need to educate in a way that they would care. Maybe it's a mixture of both,
I would definitely chime in to say it is both and.
Yeah.
I appreciate you breaking it down that way. And after I said it, I went right back to my Spotify library. And in fact, my daughter had gifted me this playlist. We call it the mini mega playlist. And
oh, nice.
It's an interesting mix of songs that she included in it. That does, you're right in that it has to be a point where we're also helping connect the dots for them. Mm-hmm. And going even further than, a playlist and the Dua Lipas and Ariana Grande and Beyonce and Drake's, mm-hmm. right? Even I remember there being some interesting discussions on Facebook when retail has, or the agencies for retailers have adopted house music in some of their commercial spots, mm-hmm. The Targets of the world. And I forget who it was that used the church song.
Tomatoes, green streams, that one. You name it.
My brain is a little fried.
Well, here's
what's the point.
All around the world, it's all being used.
You're right. You're right. But it's
in the US, you see a peak of it. But you know, all around the world, you know, the most underground records, you know, that you think nobody would know outside of, you know, some, you know, underground club, they're using them in these pop, you know, and I shouldn't say pop, in these mainstream advertisings.
Yes.
You know, again, that's my mantra right now is house music sells everything but house music.
that's somewhat tragic, though, in my mind.
Right? It is. Stepchild. And I talked to Maurice. You know, Maurice Joshua is my partner and best friend. So we have a lot of conversations, right? And yes. One of the things that I said is, you know, in actuality, it's not that we got to convince them to do house music, these pop artists, right? So we spent our whole, you know, careers remixing these artists, saving in a way that our mixes are utilized to build a story that takes them to radio, takes them other places. So their objective back in the day was to get a number one Billboard record, right? And they could take that number one Billboard record and say, see, it's going crazy in the clubs, radio programmer, you need to be programming this, and not our version, but the original version, ironically enough, right?
Yes.
But it was used as a tool, right? So, but we were never good enough to be on the album originally. We were never good enough to co-write with the artist. We were never good enough to collaborate in that way, right? So that's always been our desire is, you know, let us in. And, you know, one day, you know, Maurice and I were talking about it, and I said, well, you know, in actuality, it's not that they're not doing house music. They're just not doing it with us.
Or as the first jumping off point of, you know, creating something that, you know, the world is waiting to embrace and digest. We talk, coming from a corporate realm, you know, before the internet was, you know, as pervasive as it is today, companies began, as they began to adopt internet and internet technology, they began to use this term called digital first. We're a digital first company, right? Mm-hmm. And that means they're out of the box, their investment in developing products and capabilities was digital. As opposed to maybe manufacturing something or providing physical service.
Yes.
And so I think you hit on a great point that the record industry hadn't I would say there was that window where they were going disco first because it was such a commercial success, right? There was a whole shift in jumping on disco, and then they quickly switch gears when it became, you know, a genre under attack
and systematic racism.
That occurred again and reared its ugly head within the music.
Don't get me started about the minute that you exclude the cis white male. Is the minute that whatever it is going down. the minute that they feel not included and not able, you know.
That's real.
There was a period where there was a joke, right? Where the cis white male would have this joke about them not being able to dance, right? And that was funny. And then that floated into a space where they were no longer cool. They were no longer, you know, just they weren't held on that pedestal. That's when disco had to go.
Yeah. You bring up something that I had once gotten into a debate with a cis white male around when RuPaul had a dance song, right? And they didn't see themselves in that caricature, and it was, you know, an attack that on the genre. And the argument I remember was that, yeah, dance music is a joke. Just look at, you know, RuPaul. And I was like, you get WTF. I can't curse on the show. But it boils down to exactly that, which is also the case, the antithesis of why DE&I is needed, right? Because we in order for us to be included, we have to see ourselves, right? Organizations have to see us in the roles that, you know, they've historically placed others of a heterogeneous, you know, and very comfortable to them kinds of roles. And so it's the same in the music business, it seems.
I mean, it's pop culture, you know, and you know, that's a whole nother show about the DE&I aspect, right? But yeah. I think that, again, when you look at from the standpoint, that's why EDM works off in the way that it does, because it's inclusive of the cis white male. In fact, it's dependent on the cis white male.
David Guetta, Skrillex.
All of them, you know what I mean? I won't even put it on one person. David probably is the Frankie of that genre, right?
Example simply. I'm not faulting them necessarily, just calling
out. The reason why you felt pushback from me is because, unlike a lot of them, David recognizes he was around when he started in house music. So he is the bridge from house to EDM, and an example or one of my strong arguments that EDM is just an offshoot of house music. It's a mutation of house music. And it was a way for the cis white male to rediscover the guitar, rediscover rock, and not because guitar is used heavily in that as an instrumentation standpoint, but there was a time where a cis white male, in whatever state he was, whether he was, you know, in a emo phase or, you know, introspective, or if he just wanted to be cool and entertained, he would learn three chords in his garage, and him and his friends would start a band. You know what I mean? And, you know, if he was lucky, the girls would, you know, get excited and go, you know, right? And then after a while, that became not anything new anymore. You know what I mean? Here comes the discovery of, you turn that speed up a little bit. You interject the rawness that was born of original house music. And he said something that is really important that I think was missed. I don't know if we talked about that backstage or on this thing about Patrick Moxie being here.
Two years ago, in Chicago for the Cultural Affairs House Music Conference.
So one of the complaints, long-time argument, is Patrick, why don't you take and put the resources that you put behind EDM and put it behind the right house music record, not just any house music record, but the right house music records, and see if it gets the same result, if it gets the same audience and all of that.
Experiment, learn.
All of that, right?
Yes.
David Guetta talked about his desire to return to his roots, his house roots, that EDM had turned into this thing where they were just turning them out, and it just didn't represent the passion and all of the things that he originally started with. So he wanted to go back to his roots. He said one of the problems is that house music does not bring the energy that is needed for stadiums. House music is a club music, a best heard and an underground club, that type of energy.
A venue differentiation, for sure.
And it made so much sense to me hearing that. It's like, yeah, you actually, I hate to admit it, but you're kind of right. In the sense that the rawness that they have, I mean, I could do a whole hour just on this, right? So let me cut it down. Let me just basically say that the things that appeal to that stadium crowd, I don't know that house music would have the same effect in that way and be able to connect that crowd in the same way.
So that speculation is fair, but I still go back to the last point about test, experiment, and learn. And just in the same way that the record industry used remixers and producers to infuse a house vibe to some songs that didn't start out as house initially, maybe there's, and it happens today, right, where there's EDM remixes of some songs, or at least samples, well, of classic house songs that are used in the EDM.
Well, that goes on all the time. You know what I mean? Like a Defected will do something that is EDM leaning of a house classic, and even for a lot of purists, they will consider some of the releases on Defected as EDM, where Defected feels like, no, this is house for us. This is house, you know. I think the purists in our scene, our purists, and I'm not talking about individuals, I mean just our purest spirit, we are rejecting of that. And I think it's in some ways, again, I'm conflicted, right? Just being honest, right?
Yep.
The business side of me says that inclusion and integration benefits house music. A high tide raises all boats, right?
Yes.
So I get that part. But the 14-year-old in me who chose house music as an alternative to the mainstream, looking to turn away from the mainstream, and if the mainstream liked it, we wanted nothing to do with it. Nothing at all. It was very few exceptions at those parties in 1980, 81, where you heard that record at Sawyer's and also on the radio. Very few exceptions. And so that spirit still lives inside of me. So I get it, you know, but I feel like, you know, the adult in me knows that if a record makes $300, how many times can that producer make a $300 record before he has to divest from making records? Whereas these producers over here are making records that generate millions of dollars. And then as a result of it, they're DJing events for, you know, that generate, you know, $150,000, $200,000 for 2 hours worth of DJing, you know.
So
it's a David and Goliath battle, you know what I mean?
It is. And we're, we're going to have to schedule a special 2 hour edition of the Vintage House Show next time we talk. But in the last 5 minutes, I want to ensure some of our audience questions are addressed. So house, and we were sort of just talking about, this is a good segue to this question asked by one of our listeners. Are there emerging subgenres or styles within house music that you're particularly excited about?
So Afro, I think the Afro beat, I think has a lot of promise. It's proven in South Africa that, you know, Black people connect to it. And, you know, a lot of times we are the trendsetters. And you've seen things that are very close happen in the mainstream and on Black radio. So I think that there's a lot of, if our daughters, say, for instance, were going to attach to it, it probably would be through Afrobeat. First,
I'm on piano and that Afro house, and
yeah.
love that. What do you think the influence of technology has had on both the art and craft of DJing, as well as production and distribution? And particularly, I'm interested in your opinion of what is a very recent change in, well, not change, but introduction into DJ equipment technology with the Alpha Theta rotary mixers.
I think that the craze on that, I mean, it's cool. We'll see if the clubs really adopt it. You know, I've not heard it personally, but it seems like the reviews are really good in terms of it's, you know, having a clean sound and really being, you know, more of a pro approach. It seems like the price tag represents that as well. So I don't know how much that's going to reach, you know, just the average DJ. But if it becomes the club, you know, standard, you know, it's hard to say because, you know, you go tour and someplace in Italy, they'll be using the same board up and down like a radio board that they've been using since, you know, 1973. You know what I mean? And you can request it on your rider all day long, but when you get to the gig, they got what they got. You
right.
Got to figure it out,
you know what I mean? Right.
But also on the technology side, I just downloaded an app that allows me to make records on my phone.
What?
Yes. A whole studio on my phone that has all of the tools, all of the tools, and is able to do modeling and such that will turn the headphone mic thing into an actual real mic that you can record in and expect a quality from. And then you can export that and mix it outside of that, or you can mix it right there.
Well,
technology is crazy.
It is, and I guess I shouldn't be so surprised with how pervasive artificial intelligence and machine learning yes. capabilities continue to evolve. And so you're, thanks. I'll probably be pinging you just out of curiosity about, you know, the name.
Yeah, I'll text you the link.
And so we've talked about one of the other questions that came up was about the role of diversity and inclusivity in house music. And I think you addressed that very well. Thanks for that perspective. And so in closing, I would just look for, from Eric Eastmove Miller's perspective, right? What advice would you, you know, give to someone who maybe wants to be a student of house music or, you know, wants to create music and become an artist or a producer or a remixer? What one piece of Eric Miller knowledge and wisdom would you drop on them?
All right. So I'm going to try not to be a dream killer, right? I think okay. It's never been a better time to do it for the love, because it's mostly love and not like what when we were coming up when it was, you know, love and money. So it's mostly love. So I say definitely do it for the love and the money will follow. But I also say, I just posted something. It was Busta Rhymes really talking about what it takes to be, you know, successful at a superstar, at a very high level. And he talked about, you know, it requires you being selfish. It requires you being maniacal. It requires, you know, delusion. It requires unshakable faith that you just know when everybody is saying, nah, you can't do it. Nah, it doesn't make sense to do it. And when you come out on the other side successful, then that's when everybody calls you a genius. I've witnessed it up close with Kanye, with, you know, just all of the different superstars that I've encountered, you know, at all levels. And that's what they all had, is a just unshakable, just like a dog with a bone. I'm not letting this go. That's all I think about. That's all I want. That's the thing that brings success. Now, how you manage that and balance that at 50, I'm not sure, because you got adult life, adult responsibilities and all that stuff. When we approached it, I was 13, 14 when I started the journey. But when I started the journey professionally, I was 18, you know, so I could afford to only focus on that.
Certainly. Yeah, certainly. Powerful quote from Busta Rhymes, who will be here at Rosemont with Missy Elliott and Sierra soon, trying to convince the family to go check that out. but your encouragement, not dream killing, because I found your advice and counsel to be encouraging because it's realistic. You know, unfortunately, we're seeing some things in the world now where some of those attributes were, part of the characteristics that help people become, you know, moguls, but it's the same characteristics that are also going to be their demise, potentially. So, striking the balance, everything is a balancing act. What is not a balancing act, but a class act, is my guest on this episode of Vintage House Show, Eric Eastmove Miller. I say that not just because I'm biased at somebody I grew up with in grade school, but because he's definitely one still committed to making sure that the facts, opinions, and perspectives on house music are out there. He holds nothing back. Please, everyone, give it up for Eric Eastmove Miller. And you know you're welcome back anytime. I know my co-host is going to want to get some time in with you, especially after this episode. But shout out to DJ Lori Branch and our super duper executive producer, Lauren Lowry. It's been a conversation. Yes. Not an interview, but a great conversation with an old friend. And I'm looking forward to having many more with you, sir. Thank you for spending the time with us.
As well. Thank you for having me.
And where can people check you out if they want to hear your perspective or reminisce on some old stuff?
Yeah, so you know, I do have a single coming out. I probably should mention that. It should be dropping late May, early June. So you'll see that as part of an album deal with Credence Records in the UK. So I have an album coming out. They want me to do social media and all that stuff. I'm just, I'm an old dinosaur.
Oh, man, you're going to have to hire your old publicist back again. Give me shoot me a text about that, too.
And yes, absolutely.
We'll help you work it out.
So that stuff is coming. But Eastmove Chicago, Eastmove Shy, I should say, C-H-I, is my Instagram. And where else? Facebook, you can find me popping off on Facebook under Eric Miller.
cool. Well, again, it's been an honor and a thrill and a very enjoyable conversation to have you. Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Vintage House Show, where we have the first person narratives shared every Wednesday, 10 p.m. Central on WNUR. Or Facebook Live, twitch.tv, The Vintage House Show, and even on YouTube and wherever you enjoy your favorite podcast. Your main man, Mega, thanks for tuning in, and we're out.
Thanks for listening to the Vintage House Show podcast. Please subscribe and share and check us out live, WNUR 89.3 FM, Wednesdays at 10 o'clock.